And I will now mute all. And a reminder that everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so. If you have a question or comment to make, please remute yourself after you're done so we don't have too much background noise going on. And Alan, kick it off.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. We have another quite diverse group of material tonight. And starting right off with a share from Tom. Two shares from Tom, actually. So, Tom, you're going to talk to the slides?
I don't... Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. There's... I have had difficulty now and then pasting text into Facebook or pasting multiple lines into other programs or I play bridge on BBO, Bridge Base Online, and to paste multiple lines into Bridge Base Online, I have used this particular auto hotkey script. Auto hotkey is a program, it's been an open source and publicly available program for ages, and this is the script I have. And let's see, I want to, can I share my screen? I can't share my screen. Anyway, the first line is shows the what keys invoke it. In this case, it's the Control plus Shift plus Alt plus V, and that's similar to Control V, so that's why I chose it. And it's also, I haven't seen it being used by any other programs. The next line is no n, which is short for no environment, which means that all the percent dot 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 percent variables are local. Warn, enable all warnings, just in case. It's kind of really not necessary here, but useful if you're developing a script. Send mode input, this is because you want to send the text and not any events. You can do a lot of things in our hotkey, such as mouse actions and stuff like that, but I don't want to send that. I just want to send text. And here the next line is send text, and the text I want to send is a clipboard. And so you basically you use your clipboard, you copy the stuff you want to send, then send it by pressing the Control Shift Alt V, and then it gets sent. The speed is about anywhere, it takes about 1 or 2 seconds to start, and then it goes about 100 to 200 characters per second. It seems as though it's imitating or substituting for the keyboard, but it goes much faster than the keyboard, but much slower than you want if you just do a Control V. And then the second last line is to actually correct. Since you press Control Shift Alt V, you want to undo those for whatever you do next. So it sends Alt up, Control up, and Shift up, and then it returns. So to be able to use this, you have to first of all install Auto Hotkey, which you can search online and find. And once you have that installed, then you just have to run this script. Sort of nothing happens right away, but then when you just do Control Shift Alt V, whatever you have in your clipboard gets pasted where you are. I found this useful to be in script. I found this script useful for Facebook when you want to paste stuff right in when Facebook doesn't let you. And I've also found it useful where you want to send multiple lines, for example, in Bridgebase Online, or perhaps for other particular circumstances where you want to send multiple lines all at once. And this way, you don't have to, you know, set up a separate script to paste a whole bunch of stuff in. You just have to put it on your clipboard, and then you Control-Shift-Alt-D, and it gets sent off. Are there any questions?
I don't see anything in the chat.
So let's move on to the next one then. This is three slides, Tom.
Sure. Okay, sometimes the window seems a little broken. And when you can do these, you can do a sanity check on the system files to fix possibly some of these on a bit via a batch file, which I suppose I should send these things via chat so that people can actually copy them.
Yeah, I pasted it into the chat already.
Okay, thank you. The prompt line, echo on prompt line, is basically to actually give you the time as well as where you are. But sometimes Windows seems slow, and there are basically two things you want to do to actually fix Windows if there's some problem, usually in the system files because of a problem update, or something's got screwed up, or your disk is a little iffy. At any rate, there are a couple of things you can do. So I have this batch file that basically does two things. One of them is to run system file checks, which is a Windows system thing. And the other thing is a DISM restore thing, which is, DISM is actually meant for administrators who are setting up systems and so on, but it also has this ability to fix broken Windows systems when things are not sane. Next slide.
Just a note here, Tom, this obviously you have to run this script. If you want to run it, you have to be an administrator.
That's correct. And there are other things you can do. Like, as I say, you can check for bad sectors by checkdisk/B. But there are better tools, and there are better tools for recovery for disks like SpinWrite and HD Sentinel that can look at your disk and repair sectors. Next. So this is Deployment Imaging Service and Management Tool. Isn't that a wonderful name? Basically, it oversees the component store. I've put in references to Microsoft and make use of and so on. But basically, the two commands that are essential here is dism/online, which means that it goes on your online system. In other words, the one you're currently using. And cleanup image, which basically says, take a look at everything that's there and make sure that it corresponds to what should be there. And then restore health, which actually does the actual work of restoring any files that aren't as they should be. And then I show the error level just to be clear to people. And then the system file check, SFC/scan now. And this also does a similar thing. I'm not quite sure what the difference is between DISM Restore Health, but it does another thing. And it tries to check and it tries to fix any problems you have in your system files. And then I have, after those things, I have a variety, some choices you can choose, which is the check the repair system, echo Y, because it has to be done on the reboot, check disk C, which is presumably your system disk, /SD cleanup/F, which is short for fix. Next. And then choice, all good so far, perform optional cleanup. So there are a couple of things that are optional here, and one is to allow update rollbacks for longer. The default is 10 days. The maximum is 60 days. You can increase that by doing this command, DISM online, let slash set OS install blah, 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 value 60. You can also clean up obsolete components, which is the old stuff from previous updates. And basically, it disallows any, it basically gets rid of all the components that are obsolete at this point. So as after done all that, then you exit. So press any key to exit, and it finishes. The choice, by the way, at the very top of the screen is choice slash C, and the choices are yes and no, Y and N. And the message is all good so far, perform optional cleanup, and then I show the time. And then if error level is not equal to 1, it goes to end of file. In other words, it quits if you do not say Y. Are there any questions about SSC BAT?
I don't see anything in the chat. And as Chris mentioned, he's pasted the scripts into the chat window, but they'll also be available on these slides in the Q&A webpage. So if anybody wants to pick them up, they can do it in a couple of different ways there.
Okay.
Thanks, Tom.
If you have any more questions, just email me at tom@abacurial.com or post a question in the forum so I will answer it for everyone.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Okay, our next item is our first computer basics question, and it's all about disk imaging. And somebody's asked, can we provide a step-by-step guide to creating a disk image? And what do I really need? And this individual was surprised how many CDRWs he needed and how long it took. And then the second part is, how would he use the disk image if he needed to? So it's basically a basic question of how do I make a full disk image and how do I restore that image? And so let's have a look. So first of all, what you need. Well, clearly you need, if you're going to make a disk image, you need some disk imaging software, some backup software. And both Chris and I use these systems extensively. And basically I would say, and I think Chris would agree, that the free versions have sufficient features for most people. And certainly for a simple backup and restore, that's certainly the case.
At a minimum, if I can add to that, at a minimum, I would say start with free and only move on to the paid versions of the software if you see that there are features that, oh, I really want that feature, and it's not in the free version. At that point, you know, you can go ahead and do it. Another benefit of going with it, even the free version, normally what you're installing is the full version for 30 days, and then it reverts to a free version afterwards. So, there's just little problem with taking a shot at it with free.
Okay, so I've always used Macrium Reflect for a number of years. I've been using Macrium Reflect. Chris has looked at a lot of different ones, and we'll get back to some resources for that later on. But Chris has now switched to ESUS To-Do. Mainly because it gives you the capability to do incremental images. So tonight, I thought this would be a good opportunity for me to try out ESUS To-Do. So I'm going to talk about how to make a full backup and restore using that package. And Chris will no doubt chip in when I don't explain things very well, or he has some specific insights into using this program. So first of all, what you need, the other thing you need is a backup drive. And typically, these imaging systems use compression. And my experience is quite different from Chris's. Typically, I get about 50% compression, whereas Chris has lots and lots of big digital image files, which are JPEGs typically, and they're already compressed, so they don't compress all that much. So he's lucky if he sees like a 10 or 20% compression ratio. One of the important things is it's 50% of the used disk space. So if you're not using all that much space on the hard drive, it's not half the capacity of the disk. It's half of the space which you're using. So typically I've got a 250 gig solid state drive. It's about 232 gigs of information on there. And my image goes down to about 106, which is actually better than 50%. So to do that, I use an external USB drive. And a spinning disk is good. It doesn't have to be a solid state because you only use it. I only use it basically once a month for this purpose. A 1 terabyte drive is going to store lots and lots of full image backups for me. And so you could use a portable 1 terabyte like the blue one here. Right now they're about $60 in the stores. Or you could buy a desktop USB drive, an external USB drive. Typically they would start off around 4 terabytes and about $140 and up from there essentially. And that's really the reason, because my image is 106 gigabytes, I'm not going to use CDRWs. I mean, if they're storing 700 megabytes, I need an awful lot of CDRWs to create my one image file. And even if I use DVDs, I'd still be using multiple DVDs. And that technology is really slow. And yeah, I'd also have to sit there and exchange the disks all the time. By using an external USB drive, I create one file and I can just let it run and essentially walk away from it. One final thing that you need is a USB flash drive. And you need that because you need to create a recovery disk. You're going to run the backup software off your Windows system, typically. If that Windows system crashes, it takes your backup software with it. So unless you have a way to boot into your recovery software, you won't be able to recover the disk image. So you need to have a recovery disk, and typically the way to do that is to create a bootable USB drive. Interestingly, you probably only need like 4 gig to make that recovery. I don't think you can buy those anymore. The smallest one I've seen recently is 16 gig. They're only about $7. And that's perfectly adequate and cheap enough for a single purpose bootable disk. And you need it in case Windows dies, but you can also use it to make backups or recover backups anyway.
I'll jump in here for just a second too, because strictly speaking, you don't need to create this in advance. You need to have that flash drive around to do a restore, but if you don't have it, that can be created on any computer. So if you're using EaseUS to do backup 3, you just go to another working computer, you load up EaseUS to do backup 3, you create the flash drive on it, and then you can use it on your computer that won't boot or replace the hard drive or whatever. Now, a lot of people would like to have it around just because if you're in a disaster recovery situation, probably the last thing you want to worry about is, oh, now I have to go find another computer to create this flash drive. But if for any reason you don't have it, don't worry, you can create it on the fly at any point from another computer.
Very true, except that my final point is make sure that your recovery disk is going to boot
true.
And you can get to your images.
True.
I actually had a problem one time where I made the backup image, but I couldn't access it because there was a problem with the actual recovery drive. And the company had to send me a different version of the software so it would actually work.
Good point.
It's really important that you're able to access your disk images. Okay, so that's basically all you need. Some software, a backup drive, and I'd suggest you have a recovery system that will work. So here's what happens when you install EaseUS and you come up to the main screen. And I was really confused because I thought I would just be clicking on this disk and partition thing and it would go. And this is really, it's really this what is most important to you. It's some kind of setup thing. And how do you want to create your backups? What you really want to do is go to this sidebar menu here. And again, the images didn't mean anything to me. But if you click on the hamburger icon here, it will actually tell you, it expands the sidebar and tells you what all the things do. And now you can see that what you really want to do is create a disk or a partition backup. So we can click on this menu item here, and then we get into a very brief wizard. Basically, it goes out, it looks at the hard drive, and it says, well, these are the hard drives I see, and you have to choose which hard drive you want. Well, clearly, I've got one hard disk, which is disk zero. It's found another one over here called hard disk one. But if you look at it, you can clearly see that this is an external, it's a Western Digital MyBook. I know that MyBook 4 is my external USB drive. So I don't want to back up this one. I clearly want to back up this one that has the Windows system drive on it, drive C. So make sure you choose the right drive. And then the only other thing you have to do is tell it where you want it to store the image. So you can browse over here and go through the File Explorer, and I can get to my external drive and then go down to a folder called Z Images and a folder called ESUS. And then this is kind of neat. You now give it a plan name. So I told it, all right, I want to back up my Inspiron laptop. And basically that's going to tell the program to create a folder called i7 Inspiron and save all the backups for that computer in that folder. And it's a bit more sophisticated than that, as we'll see right now. Because what it's really doing is it's going to create this file on my external drive in Z Images and ESUS. And now you see it's created this i7 Inspiron folder. So it's found a drive. I've told it to go to this backup folder. It's now created a subfolder where it will store all these images. And then even better than that, it creates a file name for this backup image, and it uses the folder name, the date I'm making the image on, whether it's a full or an incremental image. So this is going to be a full disk image. And then it gives it a version number, and this is the extension that ESUS uses for its full backups. So we've told it where we want to back up to. We tell it to proceed, and it tells us now you can do whatever you want. So it basically now it looks at the drive, it interrogates the partition structure, decides how long it's going to take to do this, and eventually it will give me a time estimate up here, how long it's going to take. And as our first question came in, it takes a while. I mean, it's got to copy 100 gig of disk files. So that's going to take a little while. So typically, I just let this thing run and go and do something else. Clearly, the time that's taken is going to depend on how much data you have and how quickly it can do the transfer. So if you're using USB 3, that's going to be faster than using USB 2. And if you're using a solid-state drive, that's going to be faster than a regular spinning hard drive. But clearly, how long it takes and how big it is depends on your system. But eventually, when the smoke clears, you'll get this message which tells you that the backup was completed at a certain time and it was successful. Right, so now we've created our backup image. It's stored on our external USB drive. So now what happens if we have a crash? So clearly we have to access our our external USB drive, and lo and behold, one of the options is recovery. And clearly we may have a dozen different backup files here, or four, or however many we decide to keep. So we select the one we want and go into this recovery mode. And now again, we're in this.
Actually, Alan, back up one side. In this, what you're seeing there, the i7 Inspiron, that's the backup job. No matter how many times that runs, it'll have one line on that entry. If you have different backup jobs, say you have an offsite backup job and things like that, they'll appear in extra lines. Go forward one. If you have more than one backup that it was done with that job, yeah, you're pointing to it there, history version. That's where you would actually be able to access the various versions of backups that you have. So you could say, I want the backup from, you know, last month or last week or yesterday or whatever.
Okay, so that is a difference from Macrium. In Macrium, I would get a list of all the images, not the jobs. Right, so that's okay. So if I wanted to choose an image for this job, I'd have to go here and pick the right one.
Yeah.
All right. So now I get into this wizard, and clearly I can recover a disk or a partition, or down here looks like I can recover files or something. And I want to do a full restore, so I just click on this checkbox here, and I'm going to recover everything, which are the system recovery partitions and the Windows partition right here. And so I say next. And now it wants to know, well, where do you want to recover it to? And again, I got choices. I can go to hard disk zero, which is Windows here, or I can go to hard disk one, which again is my external USB drive. Well, clearly I don't want to recover it to the external USB. I want to recover it to the computer. So I'm going to select this guy right here. Now it's kind of interesting. It says you're trying to recover, or you're going to overwrite the Windows system disk. Is that okay? Well, clearly it is, because we're trying to do a full system recovery. So we're going to want to overwrite Windows. This I find a bit odd. Now it's giving me a summary of what it's going to do, and it's telling me I've chosen the source disk as drive as disk zero, and I've chosen the target disk as, it says, disk zero. And I mean, I clearly chose them correctly. I chose the hard drive, and I chose the external drive as a source and the hard drive as a target, but it thinks they're both disk zero, which is a bit odd.
Well, they actually, Alan, they are the same, because your source is your original backup, which was disk zero. And okay. You're restoring it to disk zero.
Okay. So this
is really a little odd, but it does sort of make sense.
This is referring to the image, not
That's
the
right.
source disk.
Yeah, the source image. Yeah.
I find that a bit odd. And I'm not quite sure where this A comes from, but it thinks that disk A is an NTFS disk, so that's probably, anyway, it's probably okay. I chose the right thing, so I'm sure it's correct. So now I tell it to proceed, and now it says, oops, we have to go to WinPE because the disk is in use. So what's WinPE? Right. The problem is you can't overwrite Windows directly, and you can't run the restore from the Windows partition and overwrite that partition with Windows. It just doesn't work to do that. So what you have to do is you have to cheat a little bit and run the Windows pre-installation environment, Windows PE. And it's kind of a small version of Windows that you can run for this purpose. So it will load, in fact, what ESUS does is it creates an ISO file, boots into the pre-installation environment, restores the system, and then reboots, and now it reboots into the restored version of Windows 10. And the neat thing is you don't have to do anything. You just have to click proceed, and it does it automatically. So here we are. We're creating the Windows PE environment, and then it will do the restore, and it will tell you what it's doing. Here's where it's copying various petitions, and finally it will say recovery completed, and we can say finish. So basically that's all you have to do. You need backup software, a backup disk separate from your hard drive. A recovery disk is a really good idea. And then the wizard will take care of making the disk image and doing the restore. And if you want to check further, some of the resources, some of the articles that Chris and I have written, Chris finding a backup program where he reviewed several different programs, a specific review by Chris of ESUS to do as he uses it, and then some information from Chris and myself on how to make sure that you're able to make the backups and recover them as necessary, including things like mounting a disk image and restoring individual files and folders, which is another really useful feature of these software systems. Okay, so Chris has posted a whole bunch of stuff in the chat window. I think he answered a couple of questions. I don't know if there's anything else, Chris.
Yep. No. Oh, actually, why would Windows require two partitions? And there is the boot partition and the system partition. So it's just the way that the operating system works. Linux is no different, I believe. It requires a separate partition that it actually starts up from, and then it hands control over to another partition afterwards. And in Linux, you actually need a swap partition as well. So just way the operating systems work.
Actually, Linux uses only two partitions, I think. There's a Linux system partition, and it usually uses a swap partition.
The swap partition, yeah.
Okay. The other partition that you see sometimes is a recovery one, which is usually a hidden partition. So when you look in File Explorer, you don't see it. But when you look in one of these backup programs, it will show you that there's several system recovery type partitions which are OEM produced. Okay, moving along, we've got a follow-up now from last week on solar chargers, and this is from Bob Walker.
Okay, let me just share my screen here.
And while you're doing that, Bob, there's a question just came in here. Confused about the USB drive. For the restore, it was using the backup drive. I use two USB drives. One is the backup drive, which has all the disk images that I make. And the second USB is a USB flash drive, a memory stick. And that's purely used as a bootable recovery disk. So it actually boots into Windows PE and loads the disk imaging software as a recovery operation. Okay, Bob, sorry.
Okay, so the original question was asked about small solar charging devices for smartphones in the event of a power failure. And they also ask, can they be used to power things like computers and kettles and other things? And that opened up a whole can of worms. So last week we looked at the solar pocket chargers for the smartphones, which answered most of the original question. We had a look at a radio flashlight USB charger that had a solar charger and can also be powered by normal batteries or charged using USB or a built-in hand crank. At the time I was doing the research for this, I actually ordered one of these radios, and it came a couple of days ago, and it looks like a great little device. We had a look at small solar panels with or without batteries and rechargeable power packs. So this week we're going to have a look at other sources of backup power, because almost everything we use in one way or another depends on the power we get out of the wall. And that includes charging our smartphones, charging our laptops, operating our laptops and desktop computers, our TVs, and everything else. So first thing we'll look at is uninterruptible power supplies. If you live in an area with frequent power outages or with power winkies, you can use a UPS to keep things like your internet modem, your router, your voice over internet protocol phone system, your cordless phone base station, a cell phone repeater if you have one, and any other critical equipment working without interruption. And the switch over to anything plugged into this when the power fails is instantaneous. There's no blips or anything else. Depending on the capacity of your UPS and what you're powering with it, you will get anywhere from a few minutes to several hours before the UPS battery is drained. The other big advantage is to protect sensible electronic equipment like TVs, personal video recorders, desktop computers, and all that from damage due to power winkies, which are the very short power dips where the lights go out for a second or two and then come back on again. A couple of years ago, one of these power winkies trashed my PVR, which is, and I lost over 100 hours worth of programming. So as well as having UPS for the other stuff mentioned, I bought another one to use with the TV and PVR and the home theater system. Now, the thing won't keep the home theater system running for any length of time, but it's enough that if the power does go totally out, you have time to power everything down and do a controlled shutdown before the power actually, before the UPS dies. Now, in terms of other backup power, a lot of current model cars come with a 120-volt AC socket. These are often built into the back of the armrest between the front seats. But the amount of power you get from these is limited. You can't plug a kettle in or anything serious, but you can plug the power supply for your laptop into it or a tablet into it, or a little portable DVD player for the kids to play with in the back seat. And as well, pretty much every car on the road now has 12-volt power sockets. And those are the same sockets they used to use for the cigarette lighter. Though most cars now don't come with the cigarette lighter. You have to buy the cigarette lighter cartridge itself and get an ashtray that fits in your cup holder. and most cars also have USB, which is a 5-volt socket. So you can charge your smartphone as you're driving along. There are small devices available that can be used to boost start your car. They can also be used as a power pack to supply 12-volt DC power. And it's amazing. These things are quite small, but they can actually crank your engine in the event your main car battery is dead. However, you have to be very careful using these. If you accidentally short-circuit them, they're capable of discharging a very high current, enough current to start a car. And so that can be quite dangerous. A lot of these little devices also have USB outlets, so you can plug your smartphone or other USB devices into them. Now, the warning I said about, accidentally shorting them out, this applies to anything using high current batteries. So we're going to be covering other battery things a little bit further on here. The first one is for large current draw devices like kettles, coffee makers, refrigerators, etc., you can use a large battery, for example, your car battery or a similar size deep cycle battery, and a large capacity power inverter. You can charge the battery using a solar panel, your car, or a suitable battery charger. A couple of cautions here. The battery should only be charged in well-ventilated areas. because while charging, batteries can give off flammable vapors, and as well the hazards of handling high current batteries and equipment come into play here. Now, these inverters come in all sorts of different capacities and types and everything, and it can be fairly complex to match the type and capacity of the inverter to the device that it's supposed to power. And I'm not going to cover all this in this presentation, but battery-powered devices like inverters that output AC usually output square wave AC, and we covered this a bit last week in more detail. The square wave is okay for heating devices like kettles, for lights, for some motors, or for plugging in laptop or other type of power supplies, but it's not suitable for directly power sensitive electronics like TV sets. So you can get these the cheap ones output just square wave. More expensive ones have modified sine wave, and the most expensive ones have pure sine wave, which is the kind of power you get out of the wall. Another alternative for large current draw devices like kettles, coffee makers, refrigerators, freezers, and such is an appropriate capacity gas generator. And for starters, these should only be operated in very well ventilated areas. Now, I've shown pictures of two styles here. One is a small portable one you can carry with a handle, and that for smaller capacity, and a larger one that's on its own wheels and everything. Any kind of gas generators usually require fresh ethanol-free gas, and most gas you get from the pumps, especially regular gas or a mid-grade, have ethanol in them, and ethanol is very and small gasoline engines don't play well together. And the generator should be started and run every few months and regularly maintained, which means if you do have a opportunity to use it and you run it for several hours, afterwards it's time to look at cleaning the spark plugs, changing the oil and all that. So the gas generators can be a bit of a pain to use. That said, I have a 6,500-watt gas generator that, in the event of a long power failure, I can plug in both refrigerators, a freezer, and some lights, and most importantly, the coffee maker. If you live in an area with frequent power outages, usually in a rural area, you may want to consider a whole house automatic backup generator system. You see these advertised on TV a lot, and depending on the capacity, they go anywhere from $6,000 to $20,000. The smaller ones will keep some lights on and a few other things in your house. The bigger ones will power everything in your house. And when the power goes off, it's usually fairly seamless that these they start up automatically. So if you're asleep or you're not home, It'll start up automatically and keep your furnace, air conditioner, fridges, freezers, and everything operating. These are usually powered by natural gas or propane, so you don't have any of the stale gas problems you have with gasoline-powered generators. With gasoline-powered generators, you can't just gas it up and come back 2 years later to use it and expect it to operate. You have to keep relatively fresh gas in it. And lastly here, Hydro Ottawa, which serves urban Ottawa, and Hydro One, which serves most of eastern Ontario outside of urban Ottawa, and this includes rural Ottawa, which is still on Hydro One, and other power companies, like, for example, on the Quebec side, usually have power outage hotlines where you can report power outages. And then you can get updates on existing power outages. So let's say the power has been off for an hour or two. You phone the power outage hotline. They key off your caller ID and their customer address database to geolocate you so they know what particular power outage is affecting you. And they'll give you an update saying, you know, something to the effect like, The power failure affecting your area affects 57 customers. We expect the power to be restored in 3 hours. And so you get some up-to-date information. And that's about it for now. Any questions?
A comment, you're not on your own in terms of losing PVRs. Natalie says she had a PVR got fried with a power surge. And Tom is asking whether a Tesla Powerwall is an option.
Yeah, the Tesla Powerwall is an option, but you're talking about a lot of money there because they call it a Powerwall because it's big. Art, and I forget the gentleman's last name, gave an excellent talk a few years ago on renewable power and all that. And I visited his house in Manotick, and he has a geo system for heating and cooling the house. He has a huge bank of solar cells on the roof. He has two of these Tesla power walls, and it's a very complex setup. But the whole thing has cost him close to $50,000. But he can run every the house indefinitely, independent of the power company. So
Stuart's mentioning that some of the electric vehicles is you can use as a power supply if you lose main power.
Yeah, that's doable too. In fact, there's been some discussion about you know, solar power is great in the day, but how do you provide power to the grid at night when the sun isn't shining? And an alternative that's been suggested by some people is, well, you have all these electric cars plugged in overnight, and can you reverse the power flow and take the power from them at night to provide power to the grid, which is a great idea. But when do you charge the cars then? You know, to charge the cars, you have to have a very comprehensive solar or charging infrastructure. So when you go to the store, when you go to work, anywhere you go with your car, you can plug it in and charge it. And of course, during the day, that's when the power is at your peak usage rates. So if you own an electric car, you're not going to be too happy about not getting your cheap time of day rates overnight while the power company sucks your battery dry. So, but as a backup source of power in the event you have a power failure in the area, it's quite feasible to do that. You can even use your own regular car and hook up an inverter or whatever to the battery of your car with charging cables and take it from there.
Glenn's asking a question for you, Bob. What capacity UPS do you use to protect your TV and PVR?
I believe it's a 500 volt amp. Like I said, the expectation isn't they're going to be able to sit there and watch TV for a few hours. The expectation is if that during power winkies or some intermittent fluctuations, it'll keep the devices running properly. And if the power goes fully out, then I can turn the TV and PVR and the other stuff off in a timely manner before the battery runs down. If you're looking to keep a home theater system running for a few hours, you're going to have to get a pretty high capacity UPS to do that with. And I looked into one thing that surprises me is that none of the UPSs I looked at had the ability to plug in an external battery power source. I thought, well, you know, you get a 500 volt amp UPS, and in the event of a power failure, you plug it into a big 12-volt car battery, and the thing can keep on running for hours and hours. But none of them seem to have the ability to hook up to an external DC power source.
Okay. All right. So thanks very much, Bob. That was really good. And moving along, we have a question here about context menus. So anybody has the answer? This individual has been adding entries to a context menu. And if you look at the little screenshot there, what he'd like to do is group some of those. For example, the red ones, he'd like to group those near to the top so that they're readily available. So the question is, does anybody know an easy way or a way to move things around in a context menu like that? So while you're all thinking about that, I did actually find a reference on the web suggesting a number of ways to do it, one of which was a registry edit, but I don't know whether the individuals tried any of those or not. Anyway, while you're
Alan, the question is mine. I did try file menu tools, but it seems to be dealing only with the Windows entries, not third parties entries. So I maybe have done something wrong, but it's not what I really want. I want those third parties entries too. And this is just one menu in one section of Windows. When you click on the directory, you get a menu. When you click somewhere else, you get a different menu. So let's say you click on the desktop, you will also get a different menu. So I've tried that. I've tried, I think, one software called FileMate or something like that as well. And File Windows, Ultimate Windows Optimizer or something like that is also only for Windows 7. So I've tried a few, but I haven't tried going to play in the registry yet. This is what I want to avoid. I have three machines, and I don't want to do that on the three machines.
Yeah, that's too bad, because the utilities are usually the easiest way to do things.
Yes.
The registry is a bit tougher, I think. Okay, well, keep us advised if you do find the answer to that.
I'll try something
else. Or if somebody else knows, let us know, and we'll do a follow-up.
Yeah.
Okay, another question that came in, and Chris has got some information on this one.
Yeah, okay, so this came in from Bob Walker, and he was looking for some kind of lookup table of looking at, you know, roughly equivalent or similar fonts that are out there. And in particular, he was looking for free fonts that were more or less the same as some more expensive fonts that you can get out there. And he was especially interested in comparing, you know, expensive fonts, you know, say Helvetica or something like that, and comparing that with the fonts that come with Windows for free. And he finds that even amongst the Windows fonts that come by default, some are very similar, and he didn't see very much of a difference. And he tends to use just Arial or Times New Roman, so one sans serif and one serif font. And I think a lot of people are in that boat. Now, if you actually look at fonts a little bit more carefully, you'll see that there are considerable differences. So capital Qs are one of the ones that where differences really shine, in particular the Q, the tail on the Q. And you can see these different fonts, all of which come with Windows, have considerable different shapes on the Qs. You have Arial is a very non-stressed font in that the character itself is very even. If you look at the other side of the coin at the other end at Bell MQ, at Bell MT, you can see it's a fairly stressed font where, you know, the horizontal strokes are very much thinner than the vertical strokes. So there are considerable differences, but at a first glance, I agree that, yes, a lot of fonts can look different. Next. So one of the sites I found, which is kind of cool, is called Identifont, and it's at identifont.com. And what you can do is you can go on, click on fonts by similarity. Next. You choose a particular font that you want to find fonts that are similar to. So in this case, I typed in Helvetica, and it comes up, and it shows you the Helvetica font, uppercase, lowercase, and the numbers and a bunch of the punctuation. And then it talks a little bit about the history of the font, or, you know, when it came out and who designed it and things like that. And then next, you'll see a bunch of fonts that are listed as being similar to that. And the length of the red bar that you see is the identifont telling you how similar it is. So the longer the bar, the more similar it is. So you can see right near the number 4, Arial is considered to be one that is fairly similar to Helvetica. It's a little bit shorter bar, so there are some differences. Next. Another thing you can do is go and find differences between two fonts. So you can go to Tools, Differences, and then next, you put in the two fonts. So in this case, I typed in Arial and Helvetica. Next. And then it'll show you the two character sets. And again, you get uppercase, lowercase numbers and some punctuation on it. And then it gives you a little bit of information about what it thinks is different about those two fonts. So in this case here, we see that the capital G is considerably different shape. And there's a fairly subtle difference on the capital or in the lowercase T, where with Arial, it's a little bit of slant on the top, whereas it's straight across, flat top on the, in the case of Helvetica. Note that not all differences are noted in there though. In this case, I noticed that I knew the capital R is considerably different in Helvetica and, Arial. And you can see that the tail of the R or the arm of the R is different. And the shape of the Q, the tail on the Q is a little bit different. It's a straight line in Helvetica, and there's a little bit of a wave shape to it in Arial. So not all differences will be noted, but in many cases, there will be a lot of the differences that will be shown. Next. Another thing you can do is get some free fonts there. So if you click on free fonts on the menu, and then it'll come up and you can choose the category. And so do you want a sans serif? Do you want, you know, a header one? Do you want handwriting font, whatever? And then it'll come up with a bunch of fonts that are available for free that fit that particular characteristic. There are other font sites that I pasted into the chat window. Free fonts are available from a lot of different places. And so I listed three of the bigger ones that are out there. So you can check those out. Next, under the tools menu, there's this other tools. And this is kind of cool, actually, because it has a whole bunch of things that if you're looking for a tall font or a wide font, or you're looking to pair fonts, you know, a sans serif and a serif possibly, or you want equal width fonts, regardless of whether they're bold or thin or whatever, you know, you can come up with different categories of fonts on there. So that's kind of a neat site as well, that you can find that that sort of information on it. Now, another thing you can do next is if you're trying to identify a font. So you can take a screen capture of it, or in the case of what the font, you can actually download an Android or iOS, and you can actually take a picture of a particular typeface that you see and have it identify it. So there's two sites I know of, What the Font and What Font Is. I find What the Font tends to be a little bit better than What Font Is, but if in some cases you'll find What the Font doesn't find what you want, you could try What Font Is and see if it does a better job. So I looked at the Canada Word Mark. I said, I wonder what typeface the Canada Word Mark is made of. So I took a screen capture of it, uploaded the graphic, and next, I did it to What the Font. And so it shows you the uploaded image, and then below that, next, it'll show you what fonts it thinks look about the same as that. And in this case here, next, you'll see that it's Baskerville. So my understanding is that it's not exactly Baskerville. It was Baskerville as a base, and then they did some minor modifications to it. But Canada Word Mark is based on at least Baskerville font for anybody who cares. And that's all I have to say about fonts.
Okay. In the chat window, Tom had mentioned something called Lexand fonts. I don't know whether that's the same kind of thing or not. Okay, moving along then. A share that came in from B. Want to talk about this, B, or are you going to let Chris?
You'll have to unmute yourself.
Okay, unmute myself. I was trying to figure out how to play a YouTube video and on Zoom so that you could hear both the sound and see the picture. And at first it didn't work. I couldn't get any sound. And then I discovered that you have to click this little button here. And I guess we're out of time, but I could demo it if you want. But we could do that another time. it works. So it's just this little box here at the bottom when you go into the share. And then you hear both the sound and watch the picture. And what I wanted to use it for was to share somebody else's exercise video complete with sound between myself and another participant on the Zoom.
Okay, thanks, B. That's a useful tip for anybody who wants to share videos, I guess.
Yeah.
A couple more things. Chris has got a thing here on non-fungible tokens.
Yeah, I'd heard about non-fungible tokens for a while and how people are creating these, and all of a sudden these items are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars and things like that. I never really delved into it an awful lot. I came across this today, and it's somebody who is using photographic art, and they were publishing their photographic art as non-fungible tokens on the blockchain. If you're interested in this at all, there's an hour-long video that you can watch where the person talks about why they did it and how they went about doing it. They're non-technical, so it's fairly easy to understand, but it doesn't get into a lot of the nitty-gritty. So they talk about how to get into doing this for your art, and they happen to use it for photography, but it could be used for anything else. And they talk about how to get it started, how to get a wallet on the blockchain, some of the red flags that you have to watch out for. There are scammers out there, of course, and so forth. So if you're interested, YouTube video is there.
Oh, and I thought you were going to tell us how you made a fortune using non-fungible tokens in your photographs.
In particular, she says, don't think you're going to get rich quick on this scheme.
Okay, all right. Final question coming up. It should be my question, but it isn't. Somebody attended a Zoom meeting and kept getting messages saying the internet was unstable, the video was stalling. Now, this individual uses Bell, and the cell phone works, and the other things that access the router are fine. So the question is, what's the problem with unstable internet when using Zoom? And Chris has a couple of things to check.
Yeah, I don't think it's really unstable. It's saturated is really what they're talking about. It's not like the connection is going away. It's just that you have very little bandwidth available for the particular Zoom meeting or whatever it is that you're doing. So if it really is just a congestion issue, first thing to do is make sure that nobody else on your side of the router is actually using the internet connection for something else, especially if they're trying to stream movies or something like that over it that are going to be stealing all of the available bandwidth. And then on your own computer, you can always use Task Manager to look at your internet connectivity and see how the bandwidth is being used. And so you may be able to shut down other things on your computer that are actually using the bandwidth. You know, other than that, I guess it's the potential is that the problem is at the other side if you're watching somebody else presenting or whatever. But other than that, yeah, I think it really is just a congestion issue is the most common thing. Personally, I think that's it. And the last point, I think, was added by Alan.
Yeah, I had a problem one time with the speed of connection. I called my service provider. It wasn't Bell. It was somebody else. And it turned out that I was not on the closest platform. And when they moved me to a closer platform, I got much better internet service. So sometimes calling the ISP is not a bad way to go.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. I had a lot of these problems with Zoom from when we first started using it. And I'm out here in Burritt's Rapids. I have to use a small internet service provider. Normally the speed is adequate enough to stream high definition video, but I had to keep in mind the one hint here was make sure nobody else is using in the house is using internet. And the other thing is, if you have a virtual private network like NordVPN or something else, turn that off before you start the meeting. And it's also a good idea if your computer's been running for a while before the meeting, reboot it and only have the Zoom software running.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
Okay, so a few minutes over time, so we'll skip the any other questions and remind everybody that next week, September the 8th, is going to be our regular monthly meeting, the first one of the new season of the fall. And it's going to be members' favorites, and we already have a full agenda, so everybody should look forward to that. And as Chris mentioned, there won't be a QA that night, so our next Q&A will actually be in 2 weeks on September the 15th. So you have lots of time to think up your questions and things that you want to share with everybody, and send it along to suggestion box, and we'll make sure we save you a spot.
And a reminder for the September 8th meeting, we're actually going to be kicking it off with Linda Buskey's presentation on the findings from the survey. So anybody who's interested in knowing what people had to say in the survey, we'll have that analysis up front on next Wednesday.
Yeah, so we'll see everybody next week at the members' favorites meeting and the survey results. And send in your questions. So thanks, everyone.
Thanks much, folks.
Yeah, good night, everybody. Thanks.
Night, Bob, in Burt's Rapids.
Night, Hall.